Okay, here's a letter by McLuhan. This is in the mid-60s. He says, answering somebody from Harvard University, in discovering that all media and technologies create their own hidden environments, we've heard that idea before, but he says, I am really just repeating the main theme of the age of X-ray. Freud and Wittgenstein and Empson, he's a English professor in the UK, Cambridge or Oxford, probably Cambridge, and Siegfried Gideon, big influence on McLuhan, last friend of James Joyce. So Freud and Wittgenstein and Empson and Siegfried Gideon are alike concerned with the theme of a pervasive hidden environment that eludes the attention of visual and literate man. It is, however, the hidden environments that are the active shaping forces. Even statistics are a technique of X-ray for revealing hidden dimensions. Don't overlook Edward T. Hall's book, The Hidden Dimension. As we westernize the Orient by our old mechanical technology, we orientalize our Western world from within via electric technology. This creates a kind of universal alienation of our population with regard to all the conventional forms of our world. That's pretty good, eh? Freud and Wittgenstein and Empson and Siegfried Gideon are alike concerned with the theme of a pervasive hidden environment that eludes the attention of visual and literate man. It is, however, the hidden environments that are the active shaping forces. Even statistics are a technique of X-ray for revealing hidden dimensions. So he's repeating the main theme of the age of X-ray. I've never seen that sentence before. What do you think of that? You know, he's just miming the X-ray technique. So, I think you have food for thought and room for further research, whatever that phrase is. Okay. This next one, it's an article called The Electronic Prophet. And they introduce and they say, Professor Marshall McLuhan, head of the Canadian Center for Culture and Technology, is long and lean, gives an impression of a bright, sharp eye against a darkish background of complexion and clothes, and in utterance is pithy, pocky, and dehydrated. If he does not look like a professor, still less does he look like a prophet. But that is what he's becoming, the prophet of the electronic and cybernetic era of the age of instantaneous information. And this is a female writing this. I have just come back from meeting him at the New York Congress of International PEN, where he acted as participating chairman to the first session. She quotes McLuhan. The name of the session is The Writer in the Electronic Age. So then she says, it is not so common in public controversy that the chairman himself is, as someone said, put on trial. Chairman of the Congress, and they put him on trial. This happened in New York. It was a writers' conference. This is a famous group, PEN. They usually try to defend the rights of journalists and writers in totalitarian places. So she says, it was a writers' conference, but the trouble was not simply that. Like everyone who fears that the age of automation may see him out of business, writers have a Luddite prejudice, or a Luddite prejudice. Certainly there was the usual pile of red herrings, but beneath them was the real and persistent question, what is the meaning and value of a book? Not the material commercial object, which is becoming, especially if it is a work of imagination, more and more of a problem to booksellers, but the product of the act of writing. Okay, so he said, what is the meaning and value of a book? Not the material commercial object, which is becoming, especially if it is a work of imagination, more and more of a problem to booksellers. So it says, what is the meaning? But the product of the act of writing and the act of reading. What is the meaning and value of a book? But the product of the act of reading and writing. Can this, as a total concept, have an intrinsic and irreplaceable value? And if so, is this value being put in danger by all the other available media of communication? So she asked that question. So then, She says, Marcia McLuhan, a former pupil of I.A. Richards at Cambridge, has a background of English literature, but he has made it his life's business to study these technical media, new and old, and to probe, she puts probe in quotes, she hadn't heard that word before, and to probe the psychological environment which the new ones have created. Psychological environment. In his three books, he has dealt with all the media, from print to present-day electronic circuitry, and his basic claim is that we persist in believing that the medium is just a vehicle, and hence in disregarding its peculiar impact both on ourselves and on what is being communicated. She misses the fact that it's also affecting other media. What's his impact on not the content which is being communicated, but the media dynamics, the media styles themselves? So she says, the Gutenberg era means to McLuhan the domination of the medium of print. In an ambience of print, we have all acquired the habit of both thinking and perceiving a linear and sectional progression. This makes our awareness compartmental and encourages, according to McLuhan, other psychological and social attitudes, for instance, detachment and isolation. Moreover, because the emphasis is on the visual, we become neglectful of the other senses. We suffer a kind of numbness. The age, because of the emphasis on the visual, neglectful of the other senses. The age of electronics, on the other hand, has reoriented us towards a sense of the whole and towards participation. Like Vance Packard in his book, The Hidden Persuaders, McLuhan is doing something valuable in forcing subliminal effects upon our attention. And he is original in studying the actual and potential effect of the time factor, the dramatic change to instantaneity which was initiated by electricity. Quote, electric light is pure information. It illuminates everything instantaneously and in all senses. And now, with the electronic developments of our century, everyone potentially can know everything all at once, all together. See, there's the internet meme 50 years ago. And with all their senses simultaneously. We can know with all our senses simultaneously. Instantaneous participation in depth. So that's why the internet is the replay of that. Everything they claim about the internet was happening before, except for individual broadcasting. But the Android Mean comes back and presents the collective consciousness of the analog media with your ability to argue in the void. Added. The psychological and moral evils of this collective passivity are always being pointed out to us. That in the coming age of automatized leisure of labor-saving devices and servo mechanisms, we shall forget the meaning of labor, even of creative labor, and become the servants of our mechanism. That was always pointed out by other people. McLuhan has described the media as extensions of our limbs of which we should take a controlled advantage. But now he no longer warns us that we could become spastic robots. In his earlier work, he advocated an anarchistic individual assertion against collective passivity, against collectivistic passivity. But he's played more and more with a hope of collective unity, which begins to sound mystical. He continues to preach that the purpose of education is civil defense against media. Civil defense against media follow. But seems to be ever hazier about the value content of any education. Though in New York he claimed to be in no way committed to the electronic future, the evidence of his written work is against him. So this is an early article, and the early articles tended to summarize his point. The slogan of his, well, what they thought was his point. The slogan of his latest and probably his most influential book, Understanding Media, is The Medium is the Message. The message of electricity was total change. And nowadays, the electronic message is the instantaneous participation in depth, the total involvement, and retribalization. And the content of any communication is always another medium. For example, the content of writing is speech, another form of communication, while the content of speech is subverbal thought. Never seen that in an article. She must have heard him say that. While the content of speech is subverbal thought, that is said in the book Counterblast came out in 1969, but this is an article years before that.
So say I've that again, heard the content of...
The content of any communication is always another medium. For example, the content of writing is speech, another form of communication, while the content of speech is subverbal thought. Here we seem, oddly enough, obliged to halt. For how can thought be a medium unless at a seance?
Schizophrenia.
See, there's what they don't understand what a medium is. A medium is defined medievally as something in the in between. Well, thought is in between, physical, non-physical. But they are thinking something about thought, not active ESP, which is what it can be. It's actually what McLuhan says is not non-verbal mental gesture. Non-verbal mental gesture is what is how he defines ESP. This person is saying subverbal thought.
Even ESP is a medium?
Yes. A medium is... Yeah, it's a communication. It's a connecting. It creates crowd dynamics. That's the definition of medium. So I'm glad I read this for you because you had not taken it that far.
Okay, now follow that with schizophrenia as a stage of apprehension. When you're...
Schizophrenia, well, every form of expression is a medium. Because remember, objects are unobservable, only relationships between objects are observable, says McLuhan. To know anything, there's got to be a relationship happening. And a relationship is a medium.
Yeah.
Literacy emphasizes thoughts. That's why, you know, Madeline, when you start analyzing what's the moon or what way is it rising or sinking, as you move towards to more and more to the objectness of the thing, you can't find it. Because nothing is isolated. Everything's in relation to everything else. But literacy fosters the illusion that things are separate. It tends to make society think that idea. Because you're reading in isolation, different tasks, mechanical tasks you got to do are fragmenting. So this is what people are projecting a lot on situations, and they're not aware of it. And I've never said this before, but the objectness can't exist. They can't define electricity. They can't define electrons.
Yeah, you have said it many times, and I've actually... that's not a new concept to me, but it is something that takes a lot of getting used to.
Right, and you experience it in the gravity debate. What is it? The flat Earth debate. You know, you cannot get really specific and get the nub of something.
Yeah, you can't get to the bottom of anything.
Right.
There isn't a bottom. Yeah.
But that's not futile. If you understand that the relationships among objects are observable, then you've got something to observe.
And the relationships are ever changing.
Depending on the medium surrounding. Books tend to make things not change. Everybody has to get on the same page. That leads to matching. It slows down society. So he says...
The echo stopped.
What the fuck happened there? Jesus, when did that stop? Fucking Bill. Look at that. Look at that.
It's Ion.
Yes. Very good. So back to the article. So she goes at the idea of the speech is thought, the content of speech is subverbal thought. Here we seem, oddly enough, obliged to halt. Not going to take it anymore. For how can thought be a medium unless at a seance? So she thinks medium, that's a pun. Yeah, how can thought be a medium unless at a seance? I guess that's a joke, you know, because you have a medium engage in the trance. But if she doesn't mean that as a joke, it's she thinks there's some kind of communication going on. So a literate person thinks that they think in isolation. That's the result of visual space. They think thought is in a vacuum, not involved with us, with social communication. And then she says, and it does not strike McLuhan that the content of thought may be evaluative, This, the effort of some individual person to seize and to formulate something that seems to him of sufficient importance to utter. Boy, what's that? And so she says, how can thought be a medium? And does, and it does not strike McLuhan that the content of thought may be evaluative, the effort of some individual person to seize and to formulate something that seems to him of sufficient importance to utter.
Isn't that making his point, though? If you're evaluating,
yep,
aren't you, it's object in relation, right?
Yeah.
Or
yep.
No?
So you're right.
All right.
So
every value judgment is a comparison.
Every value judgment is what?
A comparison.
Yeah. So here's the point. I would read these articles to find out, to analyze the writer, not to get their message because it's usually trivial or wrong. So what you can see, there's something about her thinking. She's unaware of thought as a product of visual space. So she's got it in some weird abstract space where the individual seizes and formulates something that seems to him of sufficient importance to utter. So the content of thought, that is the confusing limit of thought. That's the mind getting to that point where it's talking to itself and it can't get to the nub of the matter. So it slips to this other statement, which is preparing to say something. If you're preparing to say something, you know, something that's of sufficient importance to utter, why don't you include the utterance as part of its relationships? So thought is a big Achilles heel in literate people. So then she says, so we come back to writing or printing and books, books in quotes. McLuhan no longer distinguishes clearly between book as printed material object and book as communication between one imaginative individual and some others. She also doesn't see the effect of book on other media. He's just putting it in relation to people. He does not see that reading may be valuable just because it is a linear progression demanding an ordered response in time. He never said it wasn't valuable. He used to say, I teach the damn stuff. I teach literature. So she says, he does not see that reading may be valuable just because it is a linear progression demanding an ordered response in time, something which someone can enjoy turning over in his mind for himself, probably alone. There's all the conditions of visual space that she doesn't see as an artifact. That's a total pseudo-situation created by the medium of print. Turning over in your mind by yourself, alone. New techniques, McLuhan tells us, are about to make it possible for everyone to make his own book by compiling instant information upon everything. That's like through Xerox. We would talk about that. Then she says, what is alarming, if fascinating, is that McLuhan views this prospect with increasing satisfaction. So there they make the mistake that because he talks about the new environment, they think he's for it. He's actually more afraid of it, more anti it than even she is, than anybody is.
Yep.
He pays detailed and informed attention to the arts, but always as technique or medium, never as insight or value. See, there's the crux of
the value.
Yeah, that's the Western literate person has values, which are abstract judgments that are kept in suspension, as flags. And as a result, he puts all the arts on the same level, as if determined to erase any aesthetic discrimination. And he doesn't do that. He can write with swashbuckling badness. And there seems little doubt that he more than half regards the art of prose and print as a failed dinosaur. So she doesn't know he's probing, he's a manipulative satirist. All that levels of unsophisticated literate perception she has no clue about.
Well, and how much of that is her fault, though? I mean, because, like you say, you're finding he scattered these thoughts so widely in letters and essays and all this stuff. Like, you can't blame her for not knowing what he said.
No, I'm not blaming her. It's an example of the naivety being x-rayed. And she doesn't know that she should look into it a little more than make these hasty judgments.
Well, but he never condensed his thoughts to make them accessible for people.
That's what his method was. That's why he was popular. He was aphoristic. He said the medium is the message. Okay, so take some time to think about it, but that's pretty fucking straightforward. The medium is the message. Okay, so we're talking here. What I'm saying is not the message. It's the environment, the technology we're using that is the message. That's a simple thought once you register it. He used to say, "No, nothing written in books as content is important as the fact print came into society." Hey, watch your rubbing there. You're causing noise. Nothing written in the content of books, no message, is as important as the fact the printing press altered society itself without the content, without any of the content influencing it. So then later he says that's an exaggerated statement. But he says you have to exaggerate to get your point across today. And so people said, no, we must be honest. We can't exaggerate it. We got to go back to bland facts. So the preachers started saying they're bland Christian facts, and everybody left and fucked their neighbor. Left church and became decadent. Because bland statements don't work in electronic society in a global theater. See, so this is a kind of archaeology, kind of psychology, reading people's reactions to McLuhan. We really get a handle on the assumptions. So she ends the article by saying, he is a great cult in America. Now, he's not. It's just that people in the media liked him, so they gave him a couple of shows, and they interviewed him. He made interesting conversation, sort of, but he certainly wasn't known by anybody. And the populace. He was a great cult, and you know how he got known? 10 years later, Woody Allen movie. And who knows if anybody bothered to notice who the person was. They just thought it was a funny joke. He is a great cult in America, partly no doubt because of this refusal to judge between pop and other art. She's got the high art and low art division still going. He doesn't see pop as art. And on this may reinforce And this may reinforce the accent on youth and an uncritical faith in the future. McLuhan had none of that. Over here, too, there are signs of dazzlement, which may depend on a rather undergraduate-ish gimmickry. But to read his books in succession is to get the impression that he has been his own hidden persuader and fallen a victim to his own excitement about technical virtuosity. Well, he's the exact opposite. Why I find him slightly frightening is that I think McLuhanism is what the philosopher Karl Popper calls an Oedipal philosophy, a kind of prophesying which, like Freudianism, Marxism, and Spenglerianism, induces the effects it predicts. So, self-fulfilling prophecy, I guess. Now, when I asked Cosmic Awareness about McLuhan, they said that McLuhan created an action that he had seen himself, which tended to gain popularity. That's the way Cosmic Awareness is that. He actually made it up. It was a new original patterning, and then it became an action in itself. So that's what she's worried about. That's what she means by a great cult, but it never got to that level. But thinkers, for the next 40 years, generally would say he's like mostly wrong, but for some reason, it's still interesting to read him. That was like the general consensus. They couldn't figure out what, why he still had an effect or an appeal, even though it seemed that he didn't have any accuracy in what he was doing or had reactions like this. They didn't know he was an actor. They thought he was for what he was talking about. So that's pretty interesting. So there's this one article of a billion or trillion articles I found in the swamp. This one little, what do you call it, bottle, message with a bottle, message in a bottle.
So this was an article that you can assume that McLuhan held on to.
Well, someone collected it for him. It's underlined, you know, his secretary maybe looked out for it or people sent it. They collected these articles.
Okay.
Pretty well, every article on him, he had a copy. Zappa did the same thing. You know, back by Zappa's time, you could have a news service where they would look for articles on you and get them for you. So, Bert, yeah?
Yeah, what's the credentials of this critic, this lady is critiquing McLuhan? Is she a professor?
I don't think so. I think she's just a journalist.
Doesn't
strike me. They don't even say who she is at the bottom.
Oh, okay.
Just a columnist. But she was hip enough to know about the conference and went to it. Probably because she wanted to be a writer or something.
Yeah.
But you see the emotional reactions?
Yes.
to his tone or his attitude. So that, I hope you found that interesting. Let me see if anybody's muted. Who's Chicago? That was the person who came in.
It was Nick.
Oh, Nick's back.
Nick.
Why, Nick? Why are you back, Nick?
No, I'm Ophelia.
Uh-oh. Ophelia. Oh, they must have, I guess if you come in by Skype or whatever your system you're using, they give you the same route.
Yes, Skype.
Well, Ophelia, there's no ion here for you, so is that okay?
It's okay. I just enjoy this thing.
You can enjoy this thing?
Yeah.
Okay. In 1967, January 21st, a couple of months before McLuhan was going to be on NBC TV, but 9 months after he's on the cover of New York's Newsweek, the Toronto Star, so his hometown paper, this is Nelson Thal's father's paper, has a big article on McLuhan. It's called Why Marshall McLuhan Matters, and then they got to find the next part, Matters to You, I think is the rest of it. I got a bit fragmented here. And there's a lot of discussion of him, but it's too much. But it's just that it says it has a college building, a television movie, a Toronto something, and I only see half the cover. And it says, one man has influenced all of these. Now his influence is spreading. So people thought that he was becoming a big environment. He was sort of conceptually everywhere for a year or two. Probably nobody had that much publicity as he got, because there was more media, too, by then. So I'm trying to find which article to illustrate next. Here's an odd article. This is around the mid-60s. So it says, the strong controls of communism are needed in developing countries, Professor Marshall McLuhan, director of the University of Toronto Center for Culture and Technology, said yesterday. Quote, it is impossible to have our kind of North American marketing pricing system in these countries. He's generally talking about what was called the Third World. he told the annual management seminar of the American Marketing Association, people fail to understand the problems when they get panicky about communism in underdeveloped countries. Then the next paragraph says, it has taken 4 or 5 centuries to build marketing and pricing systems in the Western community of nations, he said. And although engineers can be sent into less developed countries to create production, you cannot develop a market for goods right away. So that's all the article there is. But it's interesting that the journalist thinks it's controls. We're going to control the media. He's saying that you actually have to be communist in undeveloped countries. The strong controls of communism are needed in developing countries. Now, I don't know if he actually said that. There's no quote really saying that. He's just talking about people panicking about communism and that the North American doesn't realize how different the situation is there. They haven't had literacy long enough to have a marketing pricing system or an individualist mercantile setup. So you cannot develop a market for goods right away, but you could have tribal sharing, what we call communism. So very short article, but imagine saying you need to have communist controls. You have to control people. Can you imagine the individualist of North American hearing that? So he had the guts to say, if that's what he said. Now, here's another conference. In 1964, this was geared to Canadian politicians. So there was a prime minister named John Diefenbaker, head of the country. So the article says, would a Beatle wig – now, the Beatles have just been on Ed Sullivan. So McLuhan was observing this. So the article says, would a Beatle wig help opposition leader Diefenbaker win the next election? The possibility was raised at the Conservative Party-sponsored National Conference on Canadian Goals by University of Toronto Professor Dr. Marshall McLuhan. He said politicians should get with it like the Beatles. Then it says, are you suggesting – so. Research Director of the Canadian Labour Congress, Dr. Eugene Forsey, so this is a guy who's into the hardware world of the left and unions, says, are you suggesting that John Diefenbaker should get a Beatle hairdo? And he was saying, yes, he was. But now I got to find the rest of the article.
Hey, Bob?
Yes.
Just that last article when he says, like, Western markets won't work in so-called third world countries. Do you think that was a big reason, like, IMF was, like, pushing structural adjustments?
What's loans? That?
Basically, they said in order – they were trying to develop these third world countries, and so they came up with these ideas of these loans that they would loan to these – so-called third world countries, but they had to use those loans for certain infrastructure updates or developments.
So you're saying they were controlling how the money was used?
Yeah. In the 70s, especially, and all the way up until now, really, to get them locked in, and then they're in debt, and they have to further industrialize.
I don't think McLuhan, he would say that the third world countries could adapt to the present better than the West. The West was too embedded in left hemisphere industrial hardware, didn't understand the software world because the software world was acoustic. So the acoustic third world, having not developed visual space, was actually better able to respond to the beehive effect of electric media. So he would never agree with any industrial bureaucrat whatever they came up with. He would want them to look at the larger dynamics of what's going on where you have these tribal people turned on negatively by radio because it's like alcohol for Native Indians. And so it was like fire. So it caused, that's why you have all that murdering, tribal murder in Africa in the 80s and 90s, like the Rwanda massacre. These were effects of the radio environment. So he said the United Nations was making a mistake handing out free transistor radios in the third world countries like Africa. So he'd bring in that factor, and he'd bring in other factors, and then everybody wouldn't know what to do at that point. He just may complexify it too much. So he's trying to throw light on the argument of being anti-communist, how that's too simple. They're not looking at the dynamics that goes on. So he said that when these African nations got independence, they became nations, but it was not industrial nationhood. It was a tribal nationalism. So I don't know what he would say about we're moving, as he said, the blacks and the third world were trying to become first world, and China successfully sort of did that. And the third in the Western electric world was trying to become third world. All the anti-technology movements, the ecological movements. So with that dynamic, you'd have to think about the third world wants to become like us, but we're not being us anymore, and we're turning into software world. But there's no individualism like the West in the third world, so they could dig the beehive effect. So I don't know. McLuhan's solution was we're in a time of transition and turbulence, constant turbulence, so you have to use a computer to study the sensory profiles of each culture, each nation, and determine how much radio or how much newspapers they should have, what would be their diet. So very, very strict controls if you had that. That would appear to Westerners as totalitarian. But he said that's the stakes. Got to be totalitarian if you're going to prevent the slaughter that's going to come. And then the slaughter did come. Started off with the dictatorships in South America in the 70s, where thousands of people were murdered for literate content reasons, for thinking communist thoughts or socialist thoughts, non-Catholic thoughts. Okay, so I have here different articles on that conference, so we'll get more quotes. I think they just, the conservatives had just lost the election, so they were having an identity crisis. So they allowed these intellectuals to come into their scene. So they say, 200 conservatives meeting here to reexamine and redefine their political philosophy were promptly told at their opening session yesterday that to have a point of view is quite futile. Now imagine that, telling a politician that having a point of view is futile. I mean, that's what it's built on. It's built on points of view, the religion of points of view. Then it said, that at least seemed to be the message brought to the conference by the first of expert lecturers, Dr. Marshall McLuhan of the Center for Culture Technology at the University of Toronto. He is a theorist on communications, noted for the complexity of his views about the revolutionary changes which the electric age is producing in society. Most of the delegates who questioned Dr. McLuhan yesterday about his written and verbal explanations confessed they did not fully understand what he was getting at, and some admitted in private that they were completely baffled. So McLuhan would infiltrate. This is a modern artist. He's going to use speech to make people disrupt their senses, like, and senses can mean meanings, under the guise of being a professor and a sober guy who has a sober advice for the politicians. He found a way to infiltrate what he called decent society and shake them up when they didn't expect it. And that was the role of painting and the arts before World War II. But that wasn't so dynamic as what he could do, because he could speak to millions of different or hundreds of different groups and have the variety rather than be a specialist consumer in an art world. So it says, Dr. McLuhan used the analogy of an Edgar Allan Poe tale. Remember we were talking, Edgar Allan Poe? Used the analogy of an Edgar Allan Poe tale to illustrate his view on the correct way in which politicians and others should react to the revolution of the electric age. In the tale, so here, this will be a journalistic interpretation of the maelstrom. In the tale, a fisherman is caught in a whirlpool from which there is no escape. He observes that some objects are sucked straight down while others are constantly dragged under and thrown up again. And by attaching himself to one of these objects, the fisherman survives. Dr. McLuhan suggested that in the whirlpool of the electric age, it was futile to have a fixed point of view or a set policy. The way to survive was to observe the structure of the technological revolution and to hold on to those things that were keeping afloat. Dr. McLuhan said that the flag controversy, it's like Canada designed its flag around this time. They decided to have a national flag and end up making a bland flag with a red maple leaf on it. Dr. McLuhan said that the flag controversy was irrelevant in the electric age. The maple leaf design was mere pictorial image and was rejected on all hands because people no longer wanted such images, what he would say is visual images. They didn't want visual stuff. They want instead an icon, he said, something they can get with. He suggested that the snaky Canadian National Railway sign was such an icon, a cryptic design which attracted and involved the public. Switching his illustrative example, Dr. McLuhan discussed the political implications of the Beatles, who speak with the authority of the electric age. Now, this is the Beatles have just started. All it is for most people is a bunch of teenagers screaming at Ed Sullivan. All right? This is like ridiculous. Yeah. It's like the Nazi riot, the Nazi protest, a bunch of clowns. So the parents are seeing these ridiculous kids scream and yell, and McLuhan comes in and says, see these idiotic Nazi, neo-Nazi clowns? They are the authority of the electric age. You know, metaphorically, the Beatles are the authority of the electric age. Can you see the outrageousness of it? An adult shouldn't even be talking about the Beatles, right? And he's telling these politicians the Beatles are the cue to survival. Are you with me, people?
Yeah.
Yes. That's
are you seeing the satirical Shakespearean drama he was doing?
Shock and confusion.
Beg your pardon?
Yeah.
He's creating shock and awe and confusion.
Yeah.
Amongst the audience.
Trying to find the rest of the article. There should be part of it is chopped off. I got a bunch of them here of that, Carmen. So is this it?
Bob, can you unmute Jason?
Oh, okay. All right, here comes Jason. Yes, Jason, you have something to say?
Yeah, sure. Because I got cut off right in the middle of that question that I asked.
Oh, what was your question?
Oh, about, I'll kind of add on to it now, I guess. I've thought about it more. Just this whole idea of, like, the Tetrad managers in the 60s and 70s when they, because they got introduced to McLuhan before anybody else. Anybody else, it took a long time for them to really filter down to the rest of the population.
No, they didn't get introduced to McLuhan. They knew the meeting was a message back in the first half of the 20th century. And when McLuhan showed up in 1953, they assigned me to go find out how this obscure professor figured it out. 1954. Mm-hmm. I was sent in to find out where he got it from. And I found out he got it from Wyndham Lewis. So everybody goes, oh, that makes sense. We remember Windy. Yes, yes, that guy, he was pretty perceptive. You know, so then they had a context. But they were quite puzzled that someone figured out, because the intelligence agencies knew this. They managed. That's what Tetrad management was. They knew the media was the message, not the content.
But you also, I remember you saying at one time that McLuhan underestimated their ability to intervene into the process of...
Yes. He said through the Evergreen, so this is dead McLuhan, He said that he underestimated the power of management to bottle up the many drastic, quick effects that new media could bring in. I mean, in Understanding Media, he said, we'll have the extension of consciousness, you know, by the end of the decade. Now, that's complex. You have to figure out what he means by consciousness and this and that. And there was already a collective consciousness happening under TV conditions. But it's sort of a dramatic meaning. Management certainly distracted everybody from that. And nobody felt that was happening. So, yes, management was able to interrupt the realizing the effects, the disservices and services that were coming. They didn't have a fucking clue what was going on. They were putting people like Nixon in power, you know. It's almost like the corporations were becoming tetra managers, and their executives said, we're not going to enter government. That's stupid. Let a dummy do that. It's a useless role anyways. But then they didn't know that the White House would become the word that makes the market. So many complex interacting factors that McLuhan thought that it would be hard to stop, including a nuclear war could happen because so many people would panic. But he underestimated how they could sort of half panically get away with what they did and not have a war and not destroy themselves. At least they could. It turned out for 40 years. Then it fell apart because the Endor meme was just too extreme. But and so many people criticized McLuhan for being sounding naive and unaware of management and what they call politics. They thought McLuhan was apolitical just because he said opinions don't work, images work. No, he was pointing out, he was very accurate about where politics was going and that it wasn't going to be the hardware politics that people were used to. But still, since information controlled the world, that's a CIA world. That's he later talked about this. He said the elites control the big interpretations, the interpretations of the big patterns. And they just talk stupid stuff in their big interpretation. Basically just keep fighting the Cold War and then later fight the drug lords. So they keep it simple. He underestimated, he said, from the perspective of post-death awareness, he would never say this consciously, I mean when he was alive. He thought that management was going to succumb. So what happened is that the presidents, the CEOs, they would jump from company to company because it was futile what management was doing. They'd come in, do something, wreck the company, and then leave and move up the promotion ladder. But it was the bureaucrats on the secondary level who kept their stubbornness and kept their jobs. Do you know what I mean? Not the names in the press. It was the actual majority of management that did the, like what Gene did. Gene was just below management.
Staff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think they actively limited the ability of people to leapfrog technologies?
No, he thought that was what was coming, and he actually talked about that through the Evergreens. No, it's like a very personal statement that he would he was right in the long run. Management didn't stop the flood, but they were able to stop it, you know, for 20 or 30 years, and he does in the 70s start to bring in factors like that. Like the fact that Americans go out to be alone meant that there could not be public transportation, mass transit stuff. People would have to stay in their cars because they used cars to think and figure out their lives and get some privacy because it was too social and noisy at home. So he understood the biases. But at that time, activists would say, look, fucking what's wrong? Just put in public transportation. It's logical. It doesn't pollute, you know. But they didn't understand the cultural things, the cultural blocks of that. He understood that. So I don't know how much to make of that, what he says to the Evergreens, because he wasn't naive. And he actually explained why management would slow things down because they'd be so stick in the mud about privacy and individual rights and non-collective thinking. That was what communists and tribal people did, the pagans. Mm-hmm. So let's leave it at that. it's an interesting point that he told me. It's like a very deep personal point, but I don't think he would admit that publicly when he was alive.
And Bob, he never predicted the collapse of management.
Yes, he did.
In the way
he said that Russia and China will not survive as Soviet independent states, or Soviet removed. The Cold War, their structures would collapse. And he said that in 1970. And when Mary McClune presented the Teachers Awards in Ottawa, Prime Minister Mulroney, this is about 1990-91, was invited. And so he was there, forced to hear Nelson and Mary do a little talking about Marshall. So he heard Nelson, I pointed out to Nelson years before about this prediction. He didn't have the due line. I did. So Nelson remembered that. So he said this. Marshall predicted the collapse. This is in 1990, right when the whole thing is collapsing, 89-90. It's the main news story. And so he pointed this out that McClellan predicted it. And when Prime Minister Mulroney got up, he said, I am flabbergasted that he said that. I am going to have to read this guy. That's incredible. He was very impressed with it, that prediction. So that's what I'm saying. That's international bureaucracy. Is that what you mean, Jason?
I guess I was kind of approaching it from my original question of, like, the IMF pushing these structural adjustment loans.
He would call that peanuts. That was silly. And it was silly because nothing stopped the devastation that happened in the Third World all over the place.
Yeah.
You ever look?
It made it worse for sure.
Yeah. Do you ever look at footage of the new Egypt, the new Nigeria, these countries in the 50s? They'd probably be made by the United Nations. All the girls, little kids would have little nice dresses and going to school.
Yeah. Iran, too, in the early 70s.
Okay, so that's under radio conditions, the global village. America is spreading its largesse around the world, and it's becoming an integrated situation. It's before the computer comes in. It's before the satellite comes in, and the computer and satellite can cause massive identity crisis on all levels for older media. And so even in American domestic life, there's crisis in the 60s. The 50s were utopian in their stable, slowly progressing and adapting to almost moving towards a global socialism with different cultural biases within it. But you take that image of those nice little schools and nice little countries and nice little leaders in the 50s, and then look at the 80s where they're fucking fragmented into coke-dealing mafia states with, famine and civil war and devastation and starvation everywhere. It's amazing when you look at the 50s footage at what they had going for a few minutes. And that's why McClellan said, we've got to turn off the computer environment. It's causing changes we can't handle. So if he was in charge, he would have turned it off and put it back into that 50s atmosphere with just a little bit of TV every now and then, a little bit more radio, a little bit newspapers. And he said one could, if you really understood the whole situation the way he did, you could hand it over to him. But nobody was going to understand that for all kinds of personal reasons. But in terms of managing the society, he was right. And the intelligence agencies were doing it in a very haphazard, clumsy way. And they did it, as I outline in the Bosnia ecology, the four levels of media ecology. One of them is to assassinate the idiots. We're going too far. That's what the CIA did. They did management by murder.
Yeah.
And if anybody was pushing it too far, they'd kill them, put in somebody who would be a little more moderate.
Like what I just posted.
What'd you say, Jason?
It's just what I posted onto the chat line there. The lyrics, I don't know who posted it, 0.206 posted a song by Rage Against the Machine called Wake Up. And there's a line in there from COINTELPRO where they just, take out the leadership, neutralize them.
Okay, but see, that's done from an angry point of view, as if it's bad. When you're running a dangerous global theater, which is going to be blown up at any point, it is perfectly justified to kill people if their ignorance is taking them someplace. So basically, you want to drive people to sleep. You don't want to wake them up. That's literate goals. So, Jason, is that you?
Yeah.
Wake up, well, you idiot. And neutralize, you typed all that. You said somebody did that. You did,
no,
didn't
no,
you?
No. That's a direct quote from COINTELPRO.
Oh, okay. Yeah, these issues of worrying about psychological controlling of assassins that Boward and Philip Adjei complained about were puny compared to the issues McLuhan was talking about. Nobody was thinking on a vast scale that he was.
Yeah, but imagine if McLuhan got taken out, like, with mechanical bribe. Like,
oh, yeah, he was taken out. Oh, definitely McLuhan was suppressed by the early 70s. There's a list.
No, but if he was, like,
did a fucking...
If he's
this, Liz Jeffries did a PhD on the suppression of McLuhan. But, yeah, what were you saying? And you knew
well,
Liz Jeffries. Did you know Liz Jeffries? Did you tell me about that once?
No.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
No, but if they actually neutralized him, like they actually killed him in, after he made Mechanical Bride, like what? How would the world be different if they took him
out?
It'd
be no different.
It'd be no different?
He didn't... Yeah, no, because he had no effect on anybody other than people got a little more savvy and stopped worrying about TV as a cheap medium and said, holy shit, we can enslave everybody with this stuff and they'll stay asleep. That's what management thought. And by 1970, McLuhan criticized them for that. That they were frightened by TV when it first came out in 1950, so you had McCarthyism. They thought it was communism taking over. The psychic effect of TV made the television agencies, literate guys, think that there was some collective beehive happening, and they thought it was communist spies coming in and
George
taking
Orwell.
Over American institutions.
Yeah.
But it was TV effect. So that made them paranoid, and they didn't understand. Then by the late 60s, after a lot of turbulence, they said, everybody's still watching TV. Like when de Gaulle was able to stop the student revolution by just going on TV and hypnotize people with his messages, they realized, wow, this thing will keep everybody asleep. And because they've already become paranoid and know that they're fragile, they said, well, if we keep the TV thing going, they'll be distracted indefinitely. So they wouldn't do what McLuhan said, you know, modulate the environments ecologically. That would move towards waking people up. But you
and
don't wake people up.
Here what? Comes Andy Griffith and the Lucille Ball Show and Rawhide.
No, not that. Here comes the psychedelic revolution. Here comes LSD. Here comes the youth culture. Here comes nudity.
Oh, yeah, the next.
That's what the 70s were. Here comes Disco Duck. Here comes Prime Minister Margaret Trudeau fucking Mick Jagger.
Well, okay.
And McLuhan picked that. He said in 67, expect even more bizarre forms to show up than what you're seeing right now.
Sure.
And so the management was always panicking and it was always going further than they thought, but they certainly weren't going to turn off TV and see if that chilled everybody out. They didn't want that to happen. So as McLuhan said, pop culture was the meaning of pop art, Warhol's pop art, was to celebrate whatever your immediate environment was, whatever media you're using, and merge with it. So the intelligence agencies took Andy Warhol's unconscious message, yeah, let's keep merging with the tribal mishmash of television. Keep everybody basically a snore. Oh, I forgot to say... When we were talking to Roxy about Manly P. Hall, who was a famous historian of occult stuff and secret societies, his secretary was Janet somebody. She left Manly P. Hall for Captain Beefheart. She married Captain Beefheart. So here's Manly P. Hall giving his anthropological, interesting, literate interpretation of ancient societies and secret wisdom and rituals and archetypes. And he couldn't hold his secretary to the charisma of rock and roll, a modern shaman.
Wow.
Okay, so back to – so Jason, you see – so McLuhan was writing to his daughter, Mary. I saw these letters. because she was getting divorced, he was telling her not to get divorced. It's not a wise thing. And but he's saying the world can, and he never said this publicly, the world can blow up any minute now. The world is so confused and disoriented by these new rapid changes that mistakes can really happen quickly. And that was a feeling back then, but he knew why the feeling was. He said, if we seriously realize, holy shit, we're all panicking, we're going to blow this place up, we would turn off television or radio for a few months.
Or the internet now? But I don't know. We reached a point where if you turn the internet off now, it wouldn't chill people out.
That's right. It would kill people.
Yeah, it would be fucking...
But see, that's the Android meme. We aren't here anymore. In the 70s, flesh got obsolete. People became surplus matter. So McLuhan's apocalyptic, he said people can't live at the speed of light. They will find by the 21st century they can't live at electric speeds. Well, we found out before that. We didn't fully understand it, but we saw that society got dedicated to media bombardment, and we don't care about your unions. We don't care about your hospital, nice nurses and nice doctors. Everything's got to get put on chemicals. IG Farben's coming back. Everybody goes on pharmaceuticals. We must numb everybody. Because we're going overboard, the Titanic's going down, and that's what happened. So then by 1990, the whole communications matrix said, okay, we're taking over, and that was the internet. No more humans.
And so as it appears that management is breaking down, that we're watching the breaking down of management.
40 years ago.
Right. I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah.
But it's so evident. It's so evident now.
Because you know what? Why it's evident? The Android meme is trying to look human. So it's re-imaging, replaying our history of wiping ourselves out right back at us.
Does that include the Android meme taking over managing?
Yes. Yeah.
And the Android meme can limit our awareness, our ESP awareness, just as easily then.
The Android meme is indifferent to us. Look, everybody's saying, I haven't got a job. In the 80s, people were saying, you know, I haven't got a job. Nobody's helping me. And the market just kept soaring, you know, from 1983 on. Now it's up to 20 million. And it's an orbiting Android meme economy. And nothing to do with humans. And anybody who gets in there for 20 minutes and makes a couple billion, you know, he doesn't last long in there. They get out. It's too hectic.
Going to the derivatives.
What?
Going to the
derivatives
market.
Yeah, that's the Android memes language.
Yeah.
And nobody can say, wait, let's calm down. Let's tax. Let's grab that stuff. Nobody could stop it.
No.
There was nobody there to stop it. And so anybody who became a president realized there's nothing to do here. So Bill Clinton just started, you know, fucking anything that moved. He had nothing to do. Didn't sleep much. Read books. Supposedly read books. I don't know. The last guy. See, look at the transitional figure, Reagan. The guy fucking can't remember anything. He's just an actor. He's just walking along, reminding people of the small town truths when there were human beings.
Yes, everybody's grandpa.
Right. And then after him, the CIA director comes in. If you were the CIA director in the 60s, you'd never be allowed to be president.
Ooh, that face.
You know, the obsolete Tetrad manager comes in. He's having a problem. He had to take over. And then they bring in Playboy Clinton. And then they bring in a guy who gave up. I don't read the paper. I don't watch TV. I don't do nothing. Just resume shopping. And that was
the CIA's
Bush
son.
Jr.
Yeah,
the CIA's son.
Yeah.
And he crashed into the wall. And Ion said that he and his gang, who were part of the old establishment, you know, the secret elites, they wanted to get the hell out before it happened. And they said, well, dump it on Obama. But it didn't work. They got caught on September 15th and had to do their damn press conference humiliated. That was Ben Bernanke. Remember that name? Ben Bernanke.
Yes.
Yes.
Henry Goldfarb, or what was that guy? Paulson, Henry Paulson, Bush, and the head of the Security and Exchange. I think his name was Cox. Those four guys had to stand there on, like, Thursday, September 17th or 18th. And remember, when you go back and see the history, it was that day and the night before that Paulson said, it's all over. The world's going to collapse. So Bush and them, I don't know what the fuck they said. They said, we're going communist. McLuhan was right. We must put on media controls. Forget about free enterprise. We're going to give everybody billions of dollars. Even though we don't have any. We're now communists. That's what they did.
And if we don't do it, it's martial law on the streets.
Yeah. And it's going to be martial law anyways, but we won't talk about that.
Why not?
Well, that just bothers people. That gets them worked up, gets them distracted, gets them agitated. You know, they're going to lose their freedoms. They don't know. In 2008, they don't exist. But you start talking freedom of or FEMA and that stuff, people think they exist. Or at least the Andrew Amin presents it that people exist. All they have to do is have a couple of farmers complain. You ever look at the news? They have a crisis, and they interview three farmers. Three guys. And, uh-oh, farmers are upset. So, okay, so I'm looking at for the other part of that article, but there were a whole bunch of articles on this this phenomenon of these wacky professors coming in. So I'm going to read from other articles, and then we can patch it all together. What?
One more question, though, Bob. One more question. So the meme is perpetuating the laws of media ecology? Like the assassinations continue, the advertising continues, it just keeps going.
When you say the meme, you mean the Android meme?
The Android meme.
Yeah, is perpetuating human versions of control. The old masks of totalitarianism. Law and order. And that includes, you got a problem. You better turn around and let the police search you or they'll shoot you.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so this is another article in the same conference, and it's headlined, Politicians Told, Try Emulating the Beatles. So this one should have more details than I could get from the other article about the Beatle issue. So the conservatives were advised yesterday at the National Conference on Canadian Goals how to approach leadership problems, how to improve their public image, how to approach the Quebec problem, seek a rational solution for such emotional issues as the flag, and how to apply today's technology to today's political questions. They were still shaking their heads when Canadian politics in general, and the Conservative Party in particular, rose from the psychiatrist's couch, fresh from the ministrations of experts in mental health, culture, and technology, plus an economist. Dr. McLuhan, blah, 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 stunned them with the announcement. I won't get, the details of what he was. We've done that before. Stunned them with the announcement that the electric age, with its television and computer technology, had terminated the industrial age. Terminated the industrial age. Rendered accepted forms as obsolete as the dodo. And was the direct cause of many of the thorny problems, including the unrest in Quebec. Confronting the puzzled politicians of the 1960s. He told the conservatives they could learn much from the Beatles, whose operations are perfectly attuned to the electronic age which had created them. Okay, now we have a quote. So here's what he says about the Beatles. The Beatles, observed Dr. McLuhan, tell us they want to hold our hand, and in expressing this wish, they may appear to come close to the popular image of the politician. There is about them, however, something that is new and radical. They really do speak with the authority of the electronic age. The authenticity of their voice appears sufficiently in the almost mystic loyalty they evoke in all young hearts. The 10 or 12-year-old, stirred by the Beatles, is quite well aware of establishing direct contact with their pervasive and corporate power in his society. That's the ion point, that the kids know what's up. The kids knew the Beatles were the strongest image of iconic unity of ever, blah, 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 right? And then he says, even the Beatles themselves, Dr. McLuhan emphasized, did not realize how or why they were as successful as they obviously were. The reason that the Beatles can tell us a great deal about the changing relation between government and the governed at present is just because they have invented an image in which the relation of the individual and a group has been refocused for our time. Keep going on and on. You have to realize, what the fuck? This guy can't stop talking about the Beatles. Why? They've never heard these words before. It's kind of a jargon. And he's saying that the 12-year-old knows way more, knows better than the politicians. No one had ever heard an adult talk like that. You have to realize how radical this is at the time. So let's see if I can find a continuation of it. What's this one?
Well, he's saying that the youth are more in touch with the tactility.
Yeah.
Like with the Beatles song, I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah, there's the tactility, correct. Okay, I'm still looking for the continuation here. That was a good quote, good chunk of McLuhan talk. But where is the continuation? Here it is. So, second here, get it moving. So it says, it continues on the next page. Only the charismatic, that's in quotes, only the charismatic political leader could hope to share this kind of unmistakable corporate image or corporate coverage with the Beatles. Only the charismatic political leader could hope to share this kind of unmistakable corporate coverage, that's in quotes, with the Beatles, the professor said. Dr. McLuhan argued that the electronic age had contributed to the unrest in Quebec in several ways. In the first place, the age was a regionalizing rather than a unifying influence. All Canadian regions, including Quebec, had felt its impact. That would be the decentralization factor. Now, the article cuts off. And then it comes back to McLuhan saying, mentioning the Quebec separatists, and he says, this is not to offer any criticism of either the Beatles or the separatists. They have made a perfectly natural and valid response to the new world that is offered to them. There's a section there not visible here. You may find some other stuff. So his buddy, who was on the News Center, there was an article. This is in September 64. There was an article in May 64 where McLuhan unfolded, presented his dream for a place to run the world from. This huge, amazing design, this huge building. There's pictures of it in the newspapers. And he had Dr. Capon to provide the engineering knowledge for this. So that guy gets up. And he says, warns bloody revolt could kill French culture. Okay. Now, you know what's interesting? These radical professors saying things that politicians didn't expect was part of the change that was signaled by the Beatles and what was LSD was starting to spread. All kinds of things were happening in society in 64 and 65 that would make America very different by 67. At least in the information image level. So the conservative politicians got nailed with these avant-garde intellectuals. So Dr. Daniel Capon, assistant professor of psychiatry, told the conservative-sponsored National Conference on Canadian Goals, this will be the outcome unless French Canadians realize they are battling the latest technology. And that outcome